Welcome to What is Going Om, for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. It's no secret that humanity is at a major turning point. The doomsday clock now stands at 90 seconds to midnight, the closest to global catastrophe it's ever been. With many deep-seated intersecting crises converging, it's virtually impossible to know what to focus on first. But one thing that is clear is that of all the many existential risks we're facing, the biggest problem is the risk that we pose to ourselves. But it's not too late. According to many visionary and Indigenous leaders, there is a way forward. Stephen Gray is a teacher, writer on spiritual subjects and sacramental medicines, who's worked extensively with Tibetan Buddhism, the Native American Church, and Entheogenic Medicines, a conference and workshop organizer, leader, and speaker. He's also the editor of the book, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World, in which more than 25 visionary and Indigenous voices show how the wisdom of Indigenous peoples and the power of psychedelics can help us enact the radical shift in consciousness that's necessary to navigate the collapse of the old world order and the birth of a new consciousness centered on awakened heart interconnectedness. Stephen Gray, welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you. Stephen, in your new book, let's just go back to the book that you first published in 2010, which was Returning to Sacred World, a spiritual toolkit for the emerging reality, which shared some powerful ancient and leading edge visions and teachings for healing ourselves and our world through meditation, prayer, and sacred plant practices. Since then, cannabis has been legalized in many, many places, and the power of psychedelics to aid healing from PTSD, depression, anxiety, and fear has become a serious area of academic study. But as your new book, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World, points out, the fundamental malady of our time that's brought us to this point is the loss of our connection to nature, to each other, to our spirits, to the land, and to our souls. So tell me, what is different in this book than what you said in the book that you published in 2010?
Oh, good question. Okay, a couple of things. My knowledge of the psychedelic medicines, the plant medicines, has deepened and expanded since then. I've also met a lot of really interesting people, starting in 2011, and then really kicking in 2012. I've been co-organizing the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And we've had many influencers, many leading spokespeople on psychedelics and related subjects at that conference. And I'm the person who basically finds and secures those speakers. So I've had a lot of connection with a lot of really interesting people. And in fact, 14 of the contributors to the new book, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World, have spoken at this conference before. So I've had a lot of connections with really interesting people since then. That's one thing. And I suppose the other aspect of it, in line with your preamble and your introduction to me, is that conditions have heightened, you might say, or become more dramatic, more dangerous, more the poop has hit the fan more harshly since in that intervening 12 years or so.
So, do you think that your book from 2010. And, you know, some of the other stuff that has emerged since then is taking us closer to a place where people might be willing to listen.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, that's the premise of the new book is, let me put it this way. Excuse me, hang on a second. You mentioned in your introduction to me that I had a connection with the Native American Church. For about a dozen years, I went to quite a few of their all-night teepee ceremonies. They're called peyote prayer ceremonies. They use the peyote cactus medicine as their deepening agent, their sacrament. But they are prayer ceremonies, essentially. I won't go into detail about that unless you want to pursue that. However, the man who conducted many of those meetings, that person is called the Roadman, a fellow named Canucus Littlefish, a Native American person, once said to me in not confidentially, but just, you know, sitting around after a meeting one morning, he said that he and some of the other people in his kind of, you know, category, I don't know what you'd call them, like mystics or sensitives or whatever, had had a similar vision, which is that the stability and functionality of the current, what you might call deluded trajectory or activity of human activity on the planet is crumbling. It's falling apart. It's not holding water anymore, and it's going to get less and less like that. And so, as that happens, at a certain point, he used the word moment. There will the opening or the gap in the believability, you might say, of that way of thinking about who we are and what's going on in the world, will leave enough of an opening for a new vision to come in. And so I would say that's, you know, we've come closer to that. And part of that is just like, I'm hoping we have come closer to that because, you know, I think as you implied in your introduction there, if we haven't, then, well, we're in deep doo-doo anyway here. But I think perhaps another thing that might be useful to say about all that is that a central reason for maybe the central reason for putting this book together is that assuming things continue to deteriorate on the material level, which is the premise of all this in some sense, and it comes from many different directions. It comes from the visions of mystics. It comes from deep meditators. It comes from many, many indigenous prophecies that have been around for a long time that we have come to this nexus point now. But if you don't have any sense of what's actually going on in the largest picture of the sort of death and rebirth cycle, as Chris Bache in the book puts it, then the likelihood is that there will be increasing despair, anxiety, depression, et cetera, and craziness, you know, as we're already seeing. Like, you know, I live half an hour's drive from the border to a very dangerous country right now, namely United States of America, right? I mean, there's all this kind of strange behavior act coming out. And I suspect, this has been my hypothesis for some time now, that a lot of this extreme ridiculous behavior you're seeing that coming from the sort of the right wing of the Republican Party and these mass shootings that just seem to go up in frequency all the time, I think that they are at least partly a result or caused by this increasing instability of things, that regardless of how conscious it is in people's minds, on some level, on the felt, visceral, you know, experiential level in the gut or whatever, people know that the world is changing fast. Even if it was just the climate, that would be enough. You know, you can deny all you want, but if you almost anywhere in the world, maybe anywhere in the world right now, you are seeing extreme climate events that you've never seen with such frequency before. So I think there's a level of confusion and worry and uncertainty going on. And if you don't have some kind of a vision that perhaps this was inevitable, needed, and prophesied or predicted and seen, you might say, then you're just, you know, things could get worse for the individual and the collective altogether. You know, I think, quite honestly, we don't want to spend too much time talking about Donald Trump, but I suspect he is evidence of this kind of breakdown in confidence, so to speak, of, you know, who we are as people, that people are willing to ignore this immense amount of evidence about what kind of person this person actually is, if you can see him without rose-colored glasses, and just completely deny and ignore all that, because he seems to be strong in giving people a sense that they can follow him. It's like, oh, we can grab on to something, right? So we don't want people to grab on to something. We want people to learn how to let go, right? That's our personal work. And the collective work is to, this is the path, in a sense, really, isn't it? It's like, you know, like, breathe, pay attention, relax, trust your own intelligence without concept, without belief, without positions on things. Just trust your nature as a what the Buddhists call Buddha, or an awakened being. We all have that potential. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, this is all echoing, you know, the Second World War, the lead up to it, the problems in Germany at the time, great instability, and then everybody listens to somebody who appears to have a loud, strong voice, and they think that, you know, his daddy come to protect us. Let's, you know, it doesn't matter how they behave. Let's just follow, you know, where they're leading. And I wonder whether that's something that, you know, happens always at times of great instability. I mean, we're looking now at a time where so many of the rules are beginning to relax a little bit, especially around things like, you know, plant medicine. I mean, plant medicine has been with us since the beginning of time. People have been using it for millennia. And then in the 60s, we had this whole resurgence with LSD, etc., and people started showing interest. That was completely stamped on. And now here we are at a time of great turmoil where suddenly it's in the news again. There is a renaissance and people are paying attention to, you know, it's very interesting the way that it's all happening at the same time.
It is indeed, yeah. Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure what question I would be answering about that, but
there isn't one.
Well, you know, I suppose one way of looking at that is that there is that opening that Kanuka's Little Fish mentioned is coming through. You know, that Leonard Cohen, it's almost a cliche now. It's so well known, this line that he has in one of his songs, which is there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in, right? It's the same idea that you know, when your belief system doesn't hold water anymore, you essentially have two choices. You either try to shore it up, which is essentially an impossibility and dangerous for maybe yourself, but certainly people around you and the collective, et cetera, et cetera. Hence the Donald Trump example. Or you open up to change. You know, you open up and just keep trying to ride the curl of the wave, as it were. You know, that's the warrior mentality, and that's what we're trying to find and encourage in ourselves and each other. That way is the ability to, as Buddhist teachings would say, hold your seat, you know, stay present. You know, there's an old poem, I don't remember most of it, but Rudyard Kipling, about, it's called If, right? You know, I don't remember most of the lines, but it's like, yes, if you can keep, you know, kind of like the implication is, if you can keep your wits about you while everyone else is losing theirs, you know, well, that's kind of the idea here, right? Yeah. And the psychedelics, you might say, are here out of necessity. As I think I mentioned maybe in the introduction to the book, you know, they're not the only modality for healing and awakening, of course, but they are so potent that you might say they are our strongest medicines now. And as I often say, when the patient is in this, you know, an advanced state of illness, strong medicines are required. And of course, they're not for everybody. Lots of people lots of people are not, you know, suitable for using them, but a lot of people are, and that's the point in that sense, that when they can be used effectively, skillfully, safely, responsibly, et cetera, these medicines have the potential for opening us up to this true nature that we are, you know. So I don't think of them as drugs in that sense, you know. I don't know. Do you know who Terence McKenna is?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Terence had a definition of drugs, which I thought was interesting. Once he said in his definition of a drug is something that promotes or creates habitual behavior, unexamined habitual behavior, and psychedelics do not do that. They break down habitual behavior, but they one way that you could think of them is as truth serums.
You know,
they'll often show you the truth of things, and again, you know, a little, you know, kind of disclaimer, whatever, not disclaimer, qualifier there is that it for many people it's extremely important that they do them in the right kind of setting, you know, with the right kind of container, the right kind of guidance, etc. Because especially in high doses, you know, we're talking about LSD, peyote, psilocybin, mushrooms, ayahuasca, and some other substances, they have the potential of completely exposing the unreality, the illusion of this identity that you've created, which, you know, you might, Buddhists would call the ego, right? And that can be terrifying. You actually think, people think they're dying, you know? Yes. I understand that. I've experienced that with psychedelics. And that's also where they're, in, you know, or at least part of where their great potential is, that they can show you what's true, what's in a sense unconditionally true, beyond your story of yourself, right?
I want to, you know, relating to that point, showing you what is true, if we look at the history of plant medicine, you know, you look at the book that Brian Murarescu wrote, The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name. He writes in there about, you know, the Greeks who used to take a particular potion that they think may have, you know, been made from marijuana, etc. And this is how they got a lot of their information. And people say that the ancient Egyptians did exactly the same. And this is how they found, you know, truth, the truth behind the reality that we're playing in. But it's interesting that what I find particularly interesting is when we hear about ayahuasca, we hear a lot of stories about the consciousness, you know, the consciousness of the plant itself. And if we look at what's happening, then how I like to look at it is the plant world, the natural world, is showing us what we need to be doing to move through this, you know, this very challenging transformational time.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of my knowledge about that, I have to would say, would be secondhand, like from what I hear from other people and have read and so on and so on. But one way you might think about it is that I think Dennis McKenna has talked about this, Terence's brother, actually, who I know personally, actually lives about an hour from me, and we've had him speak at our conference a few times. Anyway, one time I remember him saying that, I don't know if he was saying this as an unequivocal fact or saying as a perhaps, but, you know, the plants have their own survival imperative for their species, and they want to continue, and so they don't want us humans to destroy everything either, right? So they may have their own agenda as well, so there may be part of that. However, in the larger picture, and you know, I don't know, maybe some of your audience might consider this sort of morphing into woo-woo territory to some degree, but tough.
They're used to that.
Well, I like to think that there are maybe a multitude or something like that of spirit beings that really care about this planet and about us, whether that be your sort of individual or personal guardian angel or beings at other levels and so on and so on. I'll give you a little quick sort of story or anecdote about that. I know a psychic who's really remarkable. I've seen a few psychics over the years, and this guy I saw way back in the late 80s, and a couple of years ago, his name popped up in my mind, and I thought, there's a reason why his name is popping up again. I haven't thought of him for 30 years, right? So I called him up. He's in California, and we've had a couple of sessions since then. He does tarot cards over the phone. And so once we've kind of gone through, you know, my individual reading and all that, I start asking him questions about what he thinks is going on. And he said that, I don't remember what word he used. He said that the spirit or, you know, whatever they are, the sort of non-incarnated intelligences are more and more realizing that we're not getting it. And we're destroying the place, and they don't want that to happen. You know, one way that I'd like to think about it is this whole planet is an unbelievably intelligent, brilliant, exquisite, interwoven, interconnected art project, in a sense, you know, a creation of love, you know, from the minds that have been involved in this creation and development for, you know, millions and millions of years and so on, this particular planet, let alone life altogether. They don't want to see that destroyed after all the development that's happened. That's one way you might think about it. Anyway, what Kit says is that they're paying more close attention now, whatever you call these, you know, guides, spirits, you know, lovers of life, whatever. And they're making themselves more available. And I said, well, How does that possible? How does that happen? Because it's always been my understanding that no one can do anything for you. You have to do it yourself, in a sense, right? Like God is not going to save the world. Jesus is not going to save the world. Buddha is not going to save the world. He said, if I got this right, it's like the veils are thinner now. So if you're open to tapping into that connection, you know, then it's more available for you. So it has to come through us, of course. We're the ones that have to solve our problems. But the guidance, the intuition, the support, the encouragement is more available. Here's another way of looking at this. Tibetan Buddhist teachings that I was involved with have a principle called the Drala principle, D-R-A-L-A. The Dralas are said to be beings. But even if they're not beings, that this principle still functions. And the way the Drala principle functions, again, as I understand it, is that if you do your job properly, like if you tune into the right information, if you, you know, don't let your ego agenda, in a sense, get in the way, if you open up to intuitive guidance, et cetera, then the Dralas respond to that and they help make it work. They help make it happen. Right. So you might say that all that kind of guidance is more available now because it's more needed.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, many people said at the start of the pandemic, you know, that our consciousness has actually called it in, our longing for something different, you know, to stop the rot, so to speak, has called this time in. And, you know, there are scientists who talk about, you know, the global mind and, you know, it becomes this, you know, back and forth infinity wave of, you know, communication and consciousness. You know, we inform it and it informs us.
Well, one of my favorite mystics these days, and for that reason, I placed his chapter first after the foreword in the introduction in this book, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World, is Chris Bache.
Yes.
And Chris Bache's story is worth giving a slight bit of context really briefly here. He's a retired professor of religious studies and philosophy in Ohio State University. And early in his career, he undertook the Stanislav Grof protocol of working with high-dose LSD privately with a sitter and an intention and music playlist, eye shades to keep out distractions, et cetera, et cetera. And he did that 73 times over a 20-year period. And for whatever reason, I don't think very many people could do this, and Chris certainly doesn't recommend it. In fact, he says he probably wouldn't do it at that level again if he had the choice, because it was really hard to do that in a way. But what happened was the first 2 hours or so of every session, he said, were sometimes exquisitely painful, as he had to, this ego dissolution thing that I mentioned a while ago, as he had to let go of any identity associated with Chris Bache, and even the species ego. But as he learned to do that, he would break through all that and find himself out in what he sometimes called the vast intelligences of the universe. It wasn't, there wasn't visual entities like you sometimes see with ayahuasca and even psilocybin and maybe peyote as well. It was just this sort of download of information, which became more and more powerful over the course of these 73 sessions. And among all the other remarkable things that happened was he started to get the message more and more frequently and with more and more confidence, so to speak, that yes, we are going through a death and rebirth trajectory or cycle, but that the likelihood or probability of the rebirth part of that is looking more and more likely, the confidence level that that can happen. And the reason I mention Chris right now partly is because of your comment about the global mind. And one of the downloads that Chris received was that if I had the quote handy, I could even read it, but it's something like, you know, what we're experiencing is the gradual birth of a single organism.
Yeah.
You know, so it's connection. That's a big part of the whole vision for this, is that we're starting to understand that we are a lot more connected to each other than we have previously, you know, in our sort of individual ego mode of living. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to come back to Chris after the break, because I've read his book, I've listened to his book, and I have to say it's one of the most extraordinary books I've ever read. Mm-hmm. I'm recommending it to everybody. And there's a lot more to say about, you know, so, his chapter in your book. Mm-hmm. So just hold it there and we'll come back and talk about Chris some more. So you're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is teacher, speaker, composer and writer Stephen Gray, who is the author of Cannabis and Spirituality, an explorer's guide to an ancient plant spirit ally, and how psychedelics can help save the world. Visionary and indigenous voices speak out. We'll be back with more from Stephen Gray after this break.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor, and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers,
plus free book excerpts, audios and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only no BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the NoBSSpiritualBookClub.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Stephen Gray, back to Chris Bache. His chapter that leads the book, I think it was called The New Human.
The birth of the new human, or the birth of the future human.
And he did. He predicted there that the ecological crisis will precipitate a death rebirth confrontation. Mm-hmm. He says that it will shatter our psycho spiritual isolation individually and societally and bring forward an awakening of common ground within us. You know, he went through so many experiences in those 20 years, he died 1,000 times. And when you look at Brian's book and you look at what the Greeks did and how they used to go very close to death, what the ancient Egyptians did, what is it about this whole death, rebirth, you know, ritual that people seem to be going through that completely brings about a transformation within them?
Well, I wouldn't say I understand it experientially as well as some people, but maybe I have enough of an understanding of that to say something about it since we're here. The way I would think about that is that we are connected to the source. You know, we are, in a sense, God in that sense, or part of God, maybe you could say. Here's a lovely image from, I don't know if it's from Hinduism. It's called the net of Indra. Have you ever heard that one?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a beautiful metaphor or image. You imagine that each one of us is like a diamond with many facets. And we're all in this space together. And, you know, diamonds, of course, are reflective in that sense. So the light from each one of us is connecting to all of us in that way. We're all part of this same net, but we're all, in that sense, equal, right? So I think, you know, I wouldn't say I've had the full realization of this, but I've had glimpses of it. And certainly this is essentially what the mystics are always saying, is that when you really know who you are, you realize that you are one with that creative source. You know, it's what Jesus called the peace that passes all understanding. And it's what Buddhists call enlightenment, or awakened heart. I actually prefer the term awakened heart to enlightenment in that sense, because enlightenment is one of those kind of like heavily baggaged words almost, you know, that do we really understand it? Van Morrison had a song once, enlightenment, don't know what it is, you know, or something like that. But awakened heart implies, it's a translation of the, as I understand it, of the Sanskrit word bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakened, and citta means both heart and mind together. Yeah. They're in a sense the same thing that way. You know, as I understand it, our true nature, which is available and accessible ultimately, ideally to everyone, is to, as my Buddhist teacher put it, land on what is, to relax in a sense, or surrender, or open up into, your realization that there's no separation. You know, we're all connected. We're all part of that source. We have the ability to create, to love, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. Yeah.
By the way, before we get too far away from Chris, in case you're heading in other directions, I did find some quotes. One thing I did was I pulled out a bunch of quotes from the book to put on Instagram and stuff like that. And I've got three from Chris. Can I take a moment to just read them? They're real short.
Oh, please do. Please do.
So this was the one about the single organism. The evolution of our species is the systematic growth of a single organism. I love that one. And then after millions of years of struggle and ascent, we are poised on the brink of a sunrise that will forever change the conditions of life on this planet. And then the third one is that the creative intelligence of our universe is working to awaken not just individuals, but all of humanity. I have a little book, in the late 80s and the early 90s, there was almost a fad, a wave of channeled books that the publishers were all jumping on and publishing. And one of those was a guy named Ken Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. And he had a book called Starseed, the Third Millennium. He also had another book called Vision or Visions, just a little short little book. And in that book, which he claims again to be channeling, his source kind of laid out a possible scenario of where we're going as a species, as a planet, over the next several thousand years. And what they said was that within about 4,000 years, that single organism will have been realized on this planet. And then anything is possible because it's all mind in that sense. We can, in a sense, do whatever we want. You know, we can travel, you know, throughout the universe, whatever. And I think that's the message of the psychedelics for a lot of people too. My focus or interest in the psychedelics is more toward waking up who we actually are. But there's a segment of the population, the real sort of mystic psychonaut, component of the demographic, that is also exploring the outer edges of what's possible as well, beyond our own individual healing and awakening. And I would say Chris Bache is one of those people, for example. Indigenous people will sometimes, say that, like indigenous shamans will sometimes say that, you don't really need to send rocket ships out into space. You can go there by connecting to, the reality of what's going on beyond you. Yeah. There's a fellow named Peter Gorman who was involved. I don't know if he's still around. He's probably, 70s or something by now. He was around ayahuasca, especially in South America, for many, many years. And he wrote a book, name of which I do not recall. But I saw him at a conference, and he said that when you really get to know ayahuasca, it's not like you're going to a movie and you're just passively sitting there taking in information. That is, you mentioned earlier on, Sandy, that, the consciousness of these plants, the spirit. Peter said that this is a being, or maybe, our definition of being might be a little bit, too reductive, but whatever. Yeah. And you can have a relationship with it, like as equals in a sense, right? And you can ask it things, and it can show you things. You want to know about the origins of life on the planet? The ayahuasca spirit will attempt to show you that, right? You can ask it about life on other planets, perhaps. I don't know. Basically, he claims that the ayahuasca spirit can tell you or, show you just about anything you're open to hearing about. Or maybe sometimes they might go, well, do you really need to know that? I don't know. But, there's that whole kind of idea that we are going into this process. And this is, again, I'd like to come back to the reason why I did this book or put this book together, was that I'm concerned, as many other people are, that without some kind of understanding, that the death part of it is leading to the rebirth part of it, that there'll be, much more, in a sense, unnecessary suffering than there could be if people get the message. And again, as Kanuka said, you know, the message can be heard. Well, that's, oh, here's another Terence. I believe he stole this, so to speak, from somebody like William Blake from way back when. I forget the original source. Terence reworded it slightly for modern times, and I looked up the original source, and I liked his wording better. And it's something like, when the truth can be told so as to be understood, it will be believed. When the truth can be told so as to be understood, it will be believed. And on that note, by the way, one of the chapters in the book by Dwayne Elgin, who's an amazing guy, really brilliant, has a book called Choosing Earth, which is very powerful. He doesn't speak of psychedelics at all in his chapter. He talks about the chapter is kind of similar to ideas in his book, where he lays out a scenario that he thinks is quite probable for the next 5-6 decades. And in the first of those decades, he sees things continuing to become more difficult on the planet. But that if we get the message, if we have that hope, you know, that, or that, in a sense, tentative faith that we can indeed hold our seats, you know, throughout this chaos, then and do what we need to do, you know, on the material level as well, right? There is the possibility of what he called the birth of a mature planetary civilization, which in its you know, ideally, so to speak, might begin to become apparent about 50 years from now, something like that. Chris, on the other hand, Chris Beige, never received any timelines on anything that...
He did see the future human.
He did, but he doesn't know, he wasn't told when. I think it's obvious to anyone who's paying attention that it's that the death part of that is happening now. You know, the falling apart of the old ways and the old certainties, et cetera, et cetera. Because that was dysfunctional, and it had to end at some point. You know, I mean, just common sense would tell you that if you're putting more destruction into the planet than you're putting healing into the planet, or balancing that out, whether it's just simple like carbon, whatever, you know, ripping down forests that give us the oxygen, you know, to breathe and keep things in balance, all that stuff. If you're just chewing through the planet like that, it's got to have an end point at some point. You know, it's got to have a correction point. And then if you add that in to the visions that people are having, and the, as I said earlier, multiple prophecies that indigenous people have been receiving for hundreds of years, if not longer, then you see that inevitable karmic comeuppance is actually happening now, right? But again, we don't know. Chris, you know, it's kind of sad almost to picture it in a way, and maybe people don't want to look, maybe they want to close their eyes, and I understand that, you know, you know, so what Chris says, it's a little bit hard to take sometimes, is that he's saying that what he received from the universe is that it's going to get quite difficult on the planet. You know, there's going to be a lot of destruction. There may be a lot of loss of life. You know, that's a really unfortunate thing to have to contemplate. But again, we don't have control, in a sense, over what goes on around us in that way. So we have to ride with it, and we have to open to it. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot worse. So that's the vision. That's the possibility. That's the prayer.
Yeah. He does say that this is where reincarnation is taking us. You know, he's an absolute believer in reincarnation now.
Absolutely, and
many people, you know, they worry looking at the world today about their children and their grandchildren.
Yes.
And yes, it's going to be hard, but they don't know any different. They don't know the kind of life that we lived. Mm-hmm. They only know what they're coming to learn.
Good
and
point.
If ultimately, you know, we do get there, then they get the rewards as well.
Mm-hmm. So here's a thought that pops up on that score, especially for older people like myself. Not sure if I got the wording right on this one, but it's another little kind of meme, you might say, which is that something to the effect of, a society grows wise when old people plant seeds for trees whose growth, or, you know, trees they will never see. They plant seeds for trees they will never see in their lifetimes. So that's kind of the way. I don't want to sound too pretentious about this, but that's my aspiration for my life at this point, is to help plant some seeds that I'm not going to see in this lifetime. I'm fairly sure that things are going to become, on the material level on this planet, more difficult, you know, and while I'm in this particular incarnation.
Well, the book has some wonderful chapters. You've got so many wise people, visionaries, indigenous people, putting across their thoughts about this. Do you have a particular favorite? I know that's a bit hard to say, but I mean, what stands out for you?
Well, Chris's, of course, because he has the big vision there, the overall kind of overarching, encompassing vision. Mm-hmm. In case that some of the, contributors were watching this, it's as if you were on a public venue and somebody asks you, you only have five children, which one's your favorite? You know, the other ones are going, what? I'll just say a couple that jump out for me at the moment. One is Jamie Wheel, who's a fascinating guy. Yes. He talks about the wounded warrior and how, it's our job to, face that and connect with our potential for, transmuting that. He also mentions something about, in connection to something we were talking about before. Oh yeah. Death practices. He said a lot of things, including psychedelics, are in a sense death practices, which, if that sounds like a scary word, I think what it really means is, having the courage, you might say, to die to the limited, conceptual worldview that you've created to survive on this planet, which is totally understandable that we all do it on some level, just to cope with the overwhelming experience of being a human in a world that it's just, we don't know, nobody knows. Mm-hmm. That's why the Buddhists talk about the essential need for the don't know mind, or the beginner's mind, to be able to open and ride with that. So Jamie's is really good. It's a kind of a relatively short chapter. Another favorite of mine is Tyson Yunkaporta. Tyson has an amazing book. It's called Sand Talk. At least I think it's amazing, which apparently has been quite popular. He told me he was surprised at how well that book has done. So the subtitle is How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Kind of interesting similarity to the title of our book here. He's an Australian Aboriginal, also an academic researcher, woodcarver, and a few other things. But he understands the indigenous view, worldview. And he talks about that in this chapter. It's quite remarkable. For example, here's another aspect of this connectedness thing that we've been talking about. He has a term which I really like. He says that Aboriginal society is heterarchical as opposed to hierarchical. Heterarchical means essentially we're all equals in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like the net of Indra image, right? He said, for example, there's very, very limited central control, maybe no central control in Aboriginal society, like traditional Aboriginal society. He said, there is authority, but authority is something real. That's something earned, through experience and wisdom and so on. And people, if you're free and empowered within yourself, if you know who you are, if you were brought up that way, for example, and you found your natural way of being who you are, you can recognize authority. It's not like we don't need teachers and guides, but the control part of that, the power part of that, is not honored or respected or even adhered to in Aboriginal culture. I've been doing some other reading that talks about that in other places. Some of the North American Native Americans, so from the Northeast, for example, the French, when they came here, wrote a lot about these people that they met. And they were kind of floored at how at that same kind of attitude. Like, they would follow leaders, but if they thought that leader was full of, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your show, so I won't. BS, perfect. Yeah, this is the no BS thing we're going doing here. Yes, if they thought that person was, you know, falling into BS or self-importance or whatever, they had no problem walking away from that person. Yeah. You know, it wasn't set in stone. They weren't like, oh, he's more power than I do, therefore I'll subsume my own power and project it onto him. That's what Freud called transference, right? That's part of our disempowerment. So in many places, people have had that sense of empowerment. And so everybody is respected in the largest sense as an equal. But again, authority is another issue. If somebody has natural authority and you're open, you're going to listen to it, right? Yeah. But it's an important part of the switch. Tyson also talks about, he has a different view of psychedelics than most of the other people in the book. There's one notion, for example, there's a book by a guy named Benny Shannon, maybe 20 years ago, I'm not sure, called The Antipodes of the Mind. He comes from the Santo Daime ayahuasca using church. And he says that using ayahuasca is like going to university. You go and you take a lesson. That's the encounter on any particular occasion with the medicine, with the ayahuasca. And then you get insights and lessons. And if you go home and do your homework and apply those lessons, that's what people in psychedelics often call integration. If you do that, then the next time you go back to the ayahuasca, which is, again, the sense of that there's an actual spirit here or a teacher, you might say, that goes, oh, I see you've been doing your homework. Now I can give you a new lesson and we can go further. So he said it's the use of ayahuasca is like a course that, you know, continues and continues and continues and is actually a life path. Tyson, on the other hand, described, I don't know if it's in his chapter, actually, I interviewed him on my Stephen Gray Vision YouTube channel, might have been there, where he said that about 15 years ago, he had a experience with San Pedro cactus, also known as huachuma, originates from South America, Peru, and those areas, that was so powerful, it lasted 12 to 15 hours. And he said he got so much teaching, so much information in that one session that he doesn't think he ever needs to do that again. In his book, Sand Talk, there are these little drawings of these kind of like almost like mandala-like symbols. They're just little symbols that he puts throughout the book. He said he was shown those symbols on on that journey. And years later, an old, he called him an islander, an old wisdom carrier from the indigenous tradition there, taught him, showed him those same symbols. It's like, here, Tyson, here's some symbols that you could understand and use. And he goes, wait, I saw those symbols years ago in my San Pedro experience. And he said he learned a completely different way of understanding the role of the relationship between men and women and the role of women and a bunch of things that he didn't know before. So he cautions people in the chapter that if you feel like you have to keep coming back to doing the psychedelic over and over and over again, maybe you're not really getting what it's trying to show you. He says at his opening, I wish I had it in front of me, his opening line in the chapter is something like, before you go charging off into the cosmos in all your orgasmic splendor, that's fairly close to what he said, develop a relationship with the rock beneath your feet. And then later in the chapter, he said something about, if you don't have a connection to the earth and to the community when you're doing these medicines, you'll be stuck in an entropic loop, I think was his word, a loop of entropy, and no responsibilities will be given to you or asked of you. So a cautionary note in that regard. Yeah.
We only have about a minute left. I would like to ask you, what do you most want people to know about this book?
That if you use psychedelics wisely and carefully in the right kind of context with the right kind of people, like in a container with a ceremonial leader, with a guide, with a sitter, with a therapist that you can that you know enough about to trust, and you trust the process and you can trust the process of surrendering into this, you will learn things that will help you immensely in your life. And almost more importantly, that being the ground for participating in the change that needs to happen, that it's doable. We're going to see almost certainly very difficult times coming up. But if we know that that had to happen for there to be the opening necessary for the birth of the future human, then hopefully we'll have some confidence, some faith, and be able to hold our seats while we go through this process.
You also organized the conferences, the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference. You did that in 2022. Are you going to be doing it again this year?
We are. We have an amazing lineup again. Paul Stamets, for example, is the most well-known of them all.
Yes.
And he's incredible. We've had him at the conference once before. He's a masterful speaker. He really is. I love the way Paul does talks. I tell people, if you want to learn how to do a talk properly, watch the watch Paul Stamets' talk at the 2018 Spirit Plant Medicine Conference. Yeah. As again, we have a very a wide variety. We have lots of BIPOC inclusion, indigenous people from various traditions.
I'm going to have to stop you right there, Stephen, because we literally are seconds away. Thank you for joining us today. I want people to know the title again, How Psychedelics Can Help Save the World, Visionary and Indigenous Voices Speak Out. And both his books are published by Park Street Press, an imprint of Inner Traditions. If you want to know more about Stephen Gray's books, events, and vision mission, visit his website, stephengrayvision.com. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back with another edition of What Is Going On at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me. And thank you to Stephen Gray.